This podcast is a service of Bridgeway Community Church in Rockford, Michigan. Thanks for listening. Here's today's message.
Well, good morning, Bridgeway. It's great to see you here today. I want to welcome you, especially those of you who are in person. Also want to take a moment and welcome those of you who are joining us at church online via our live stream. It is so good to be together and to be connected on this day. I'm excited to be together, and we're going to wrap up this great series we've been in called Own the Vision. We've been reading through this book of Nehemiah, and if you're here today, maybe for the first time, you're kind of coming to the very end of this book, and it's kind of a strange chapter to end the book of Nehemiah on. In fact, I kind of wrestled with God all week about, like, God, do we really have to preach and teach Nehemiah 13? And I was struggling with it, but I think that what this chapter is going to teach us is something that we all need in the way of revival. To kind of get us thinking about this, let me just ask you a question. I'm looking around the room, and I want to kind of get you thinking for a moment. How many of you would say you're here today and you are retired? You've hit that stage of life, you're retired. Raise your hand proud, you know, you earned it, right? All right, that's one group of people. Now, the second group of people are probably in the middle somewhere. Like, they're not retired yet, but you can see it. It's on the horizon. Raise your hand if it's like, it's in your future. Like, you can almost see it happening. Yeah, it's like you're dreaming about it, right? All right, and then the last group of people, how many of you would say, you know what, retirement pastor? I mean, it's like, I can't even see that far yet. Like, I don't even know if that's possible. Or maybe you don't want to retire. You haven't even gotten started yet, right? Like, you're thinking, like, I'm just getting started in this thing. It's like, it's a long ways off. You know, I don't want to retire. I want to die with my boots on, right? I know this about retirement. Whatever you feel is in your future, you want your retirement to be conflict-free, right? You want it to be drama-free. You've worked all your life. You've had a stressful job, and you want it to be just this easy time, no conflict. I envision my retirement with just lots of, like, white sand beach, you know, like, sun. In fact, this past week, I was trying to cheer up my wife. It was kind of a difficult week in the Albach household. My oldest son, Brennan, went off to the Coast Guard. He had enlisted, and this past week, he shipped out. And so it was a real emotional week, especially for Sean and me, too, just missing him. But we're excited for him, and I'm trying to kind of cheer my wife up, like, hey, it's only 8 weeks of basic training, and then he's going to get shipped off. And I'm like, sweetie, Coast Guard, like, he's going to get stationed somewhere on water. And so I'm saying, you're like, maybe, like, we can start kind of checking out some pre-retirement spots, like, I don't know, Virgin Islands, Puerto Rico, Hawaii, right? Like, I'm thinking, like, this could be good. We'll go visit them. And didn't really cheer her up, but I, you know, made me kind of think of what our future could be like. You're going to see this morning in the book of Nehemiah that he's actually at a place of retirement. We're going to fast forward to the very end of this book, and you're going to see that Nehemiah is not only retired, he has to come back out of retirement to deal with all the problems back in Jerusalem. And I want you to see that conflict-free is not what his retirement is looking like. In fact, I don't even think retirement is on his mind. I think he's actually looking for revival. I think what Nehemiah, throughout this entire book, this entire vision, all of his leadership is about bringing people into a personal spiritual revival. And that's what I want to talk to you about today. Nehemiah has some hard words to say to the people of God, the people who should be following God. And it's going to lead to three reforms. And these three reforms allow us as well an opportunity to have revival in our lives as well. You know, you think about Nehemiah, he had a really tough vision assignment. I mean, his vision to come back into Jerusalem after it had been left in rubble for 141 years is a hard ask. He has to leave a really good job, kind of a great job, actually, and organize people and organize a project, and he gets it done. He gets all these people working together, fighting and, you know, kind of getting over their own selfishness and greed, and he's working through obstacles and critics, and he works through all of that because he isn't afraid to get his hands dirty. He rebuilds this wall 40 feet high, 3 miles around the city of Jerusalem. It's a really, really big project. And not only does he get the wall rebuilt, but he gets the church reestablished. And we looked at this last week about how the church, the people gathered together, they turn out. I mean, a lot of people, the entire remnant of Jerusalem, 50,000 people. And they're in revival. They're in this spiritual kind of high of coming back to God. And Nehemiah not only gets the people back together, he not only gets the church reestablished, he gets them to open the book. He gets them to open the Bible and to begin to live their lives by this book. It's a great moment. I mean, this man has devoted 12 years of his life to this project. And I'll tell you, this really should tell us something about Nehemiah and should inspire all of us. Nehemiah loves God, and he loves these people, and he loves the city in which God has called them to. He absolutely loves Jerusalem. I was thinking this week about how, you know, we can think Jerusalem just so far off and this point in history so far ago, but we have a lot to thank Nehemiah for today. In fact, this city, Jerusalem, would be the city that Jesus would come to and minister to and care for these people, and they would reject Jesus. In fact, that becomes the story of Easter and Good Friday, where Jesus, just outside of the city, just outside of this wall, would be crucified. It wouldn't be the end of the story. As we know, 3 days later, Jesus would be resurrected. And Jesus, as he would ascend to heaven, he would tell his disciples kind of these last words, these parting words. And I want you to see what this has to do with the city. Acts 1, verse 8, it says, "You, my disciples, will be my witnesses in Jerusalem and in all Judea and Samaria and to the ends of the earth." Think about this statement. I mean, Nehemiah started this revitalization of Jerusalem. And Jesus then comes and he says, "You will now be my witnesses here in Jerusalem," and it'll spread out. It'll go to Judea and Samaria, bordering further and further, all the way to the ends of the earth. And you're here today, and I'm here today, and we've heard that message because Nehemiah was faithful to his vision. That message did go out of Jerusalem. It did go to the ends of the earth and reach us here in this place today. As I've said about Nehemiah, he's just a regular guy. He's just kind of being obedient in his faith. He's not a pastor. He's not a prophet. He's just a regular dude who works really, really hard. He's got kind of what I would call grit and endurance, and he just gets the job done. 52 days later, the wall is rebuilt, restored, back in whole. And he's been on this leave. Nehemiah, as I have said throughout the series, he's been kind of on this leave. It would have been unpaid. It would have been a volunteer position to go back and rebuild this wall. And he gets nominated as governor, so now he's like got this high elected government official position as a volunteer. Would have been a stressful time for Nehemiah. And so he finishes the wall, he gets the great project done, and he does what probably many of us would do, like kind of goes out on a high note. He retires. He goes back to his old job for the king in Susa, in Persia, and he takes it easy. He probably, you know, picks up golf, learns Texas Hold'em. I don't know what he does in retirement, but he's in retirement, and then he's going to, I wish the story would end right there. I wish we could kind of just say that the story ended like most fairy tales, right? And they lived happily ever after. But the story doesn't end there. In fact, the people in Jerusalem fall back into a pattern of sin, back into a pattern of getting away from God. And Nehemiah, I mean, I would have loved to have ended last week. That was the fairy tale, right? Like 50,000 people worshiping God. That would have been amazing to witness and to see. And it doesn't end there because they fall back into this problem of sin and error and human wrong. And it points us to the need for a savior solution. And so now Nehemiah is going to have to come out of retirement, and he's going to come back into the city. And I'll just kind of tell you, as we're about to read Nehemiah 13, that this is maybe not the best parting shot of a leader. It's maybe not the best way to have to kind of have an image of Nehemiah, because he is not at his best at this point. It's sort of unpleasant. Nehemiah is really going to absolutely lose his mind in this chapter. He's going to yell at someone, he's going to get angry, he's going to chuck some stuff out of the temple, and he's going to pull a guy's hair out. Like, I'm just warning you right now, he's doing these things because he needs the people to see the reform that's needed, and it's going to lead them in an opportunity for personal spiritual revival. We're going to kind of read through parts of chapter 13. It's a long chapter, so we're going to start with the first reform in Nehemiah 13, starting in verse 4. It says, "Before this, Eliashib, the priest, had been put in charge of the storerooms of the house of our God. He was closely associated with Tobiah, and he had provided him with a large room formerly used to store the grain offerings and incense and temple articles, and also the tithes of grain, new wine, and olive oil prescribed for the Levites, musicians, and gatekeepers, as well as the contributions for the priests. But while all this was going on, I was not in Jerusalem." This is Nehemiah. "For in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, I had returned to the king. Sometime later, I asked his permission and came back to Jerusalem. Here I learned about the evil thing Eliashib had done by providing Tobiah a room in the courts of the house of God. I was greatly displeased, and I threw all of Tobiah's household goods out of the room. I gave orders to purify the rooms, and then I put back into them the equipment of the house of God, with the grain offerings and the incense. Now let me kind of give you a little bit of background here. This is sort of the example of when the cat's away, the mice will play. And Nehemiah goes back to Susa, and while he's gone, he realizes that the pastor, the priest, Eliashib, allows sort of his old nemesis, Tobiah, to come and to not actually just come into the temple, but to come and like create his own little room inside of the temple. And it just drives him crazy. In fact, you see Nehemiah in this place, and you might be wondering, like, what happened to Nehemiah? I mean, what happened to our guy who's, like, always in control, and it didn't matter, like, nothing seemed to rattle him until this point. He becomes kind of unglued. What happened to sweet Nehemiah, right? Like, I was thinking this week, like what's happened to all the sweet Christians in the world? I shared last week that when I was a kid, I'd go to church with my grandma, and I was just a real little guy, and my grandma, she had all these sweet old lady friends and just like all these sweet Christians. And I'd kind of walk my grandma across the street. We'd go to church together. And I remember like sitting in the basement on the floor as a little kid and having my Bible open and sitting in grandma's Bible study at church. And all these ladies, all these sweet ladies would ask how I was doing. And they were just so kind to me. It's like you get to this point in the scripture and it's like, hey, where are the sweet people? Like, where are the nice Christians? It seems like Nehemiah has just kind of like gone maybe a bit too far with it. And I'll tell you why. He knows that this church is in big trouble. He knows that this church has allowed some things to come back into it. Now, this pastor, this priest, Eliashib, think about a pastor for a moment. What's the primary responsibility of a pastor? It's to protect the sheep, right? Like, you protect the sheep, and that means that sometimes in your protection of the sheep, you need to shoot some wolves, right? Like, that's a good pastor. In fact, think of Jesus for a moment, right? Think of the words of Jesus. He says, I am the good shepherd. And think about that. The good shepherd would do whatever it takes to protect his sheep. It's a high calling, right? Like, you know, the good shepherd will leave the 99 and go after the one lost sheep. In fact, Jesus even says that the good shepherd will lay down his life for the sheep. I mean, being a good shepherd, being a good pastor of people means you protect the sheep, and sometimes you have to shoot some wolves. And Tobiah is this wolf in sheep's clothing. Do you remember Tobiah and Sanballat? I brought him up, I think, like three times in this series. And these guys are sort of the critics to this whole project. They're not God followers. In fact, they're of another religion. They're God haters. And they want nothing more than to see Nehemiah's project come to ruin. They don't want to see the church established back in Jerusalem. And so they say all sorts of things, like Tobiah is known for saying, like, oh, you know, this project will fail. Even if a fox were to climb up on the wall, it would just crumble back down. And you remember Tobiah, he gets like this big mob scene, this big group of critics to like kind of like go against this wall, this project. I mean, he's just absolutely opposed to God. And the pastor Eli says, hey, Tobiah, look, we know you hate God, you're opposed to God's work, but you know, I'm willing to overlook that. In fact, why don't you just come and why don't you like build yourself a nice condo here in our church? You know, you can have free rent, free food. You can kind of have anything you want. I mean, this would be the equivalent of the Joker living in the Batcave, right? Like, I mean, Batman's not going to go for this. This is just not right on any level. And this begins to kind of open up for us why this reform was needed. And it begins to open up for us what personal revival is. I would say very simply, personal revival is about truthfulness over tolerance. I got to tell you, friends, when I look out at the world, and frankly, even when I look at the church today, I find myself just longing for truthfulness. And yet I see so often people and churches just settle for tolerance, just settle for tolerating almost any and anything that goes on. And I just want to say to you, as your pastor, that there should be some things that are clearly this sacred versus secular divide. There should be some things that are holy and some things that we can recognize that are just profane. And the church should be that place that's sacred. The church should be the place where there are just some things that are just sort of off limits. I mean, this is the place that God is to be worshipped. And Nehemiah kind of comes unhinged because he sees that this church has given up on truthfulness and they're just tolerating sin in the church. And it's affecting the church body. In fact, you have to kind of read between the lines, but it says that in this church that, you know, Tobiah had moved into where all the tithes and offerings were being stored, which in that day was food, it was grain. And because there was no storage, people stopped giving their tithes and offerings. And so musicians and priests, the Levites, they were no longer being paid. They were not getting just even the food that they needed to eat. Now, I was thinking about just kind of some modern ways that maybe this happens. I was thinking of one that was sort of hypothetical, but I was thinking of one that was that actually does happen today. And I'll give you kind of both of these examples because they get me fired up, and this is cheaper than therapy. So I'll just kind of share these with you right now. The first would be, I was driving in the car this week with my son, and the newscast said that Kanye West is now worth $6 billion. Let that sink in for just a moment. And I have nothing against Kanye West. I mean, make all the billions you can make, right? But my son is having to kind of explain to me, well, yeah, Dad, it's because of these shoes, these Yeezy shoes. And I don't have much for fashion, so I don't own a pair of Yeezys, but $6 billion this man is worth, largely because of his fashion and music and all the other things that he does. But I just got to thinking, like I mean, just hypothetically, what would it look like if, let's just say I ran into Kanye, right? Like I'm on the West Coast and I run into him and he's like, hey, I want to open up a distribution center in the Midwest. And I'm like, wow, well, you know, my church, we have, I don't know if you realize this, we have 20,000 square feet of like storage space, warehouse space right here in the building. And I could be thinking, right, because I came from a business background, like Kanye, Bridgeway, like it just kind of makes sense, right? Like, you know, like we could like store his shoes, we could become a distribution center, and Kanye's like, deal. In fact, everyone at Bridgeway gets a pair of Yeezys, right? Like Yeezys for Jesus, right? Like it's got this whole thing to it, and all of a sudden you're coming to church, but you're noticing there's way more traffic in that warehouse, like trucks coming in and out, And I would just say, I would hope somebody would stand up and someone would say, well, wait a minute, Pastor, like, that's all good and all, but is that our primary business as the church? I mean, are we into selling shoes or are we into saving souls? And again, there should be some things in the church that we just say, whoa, wait a minute, like, let's not rationalize this. Let's go for truthfulness and not just tolerance, and not even just tolerance in the sake of a dollar. I'll tell you, bad Christian teaching will lead to this. It'll lead to tolerance where we'll just start to accept, oh, that's good. That's good for business. That's got to be good for the church. And it becomes just tolerance. I'll give you one more example, and this one's more from real life. And it frustrates me because of my strongly held beliefs about what the calling of a pastor is. And I'll tell you, there are some pastors who basically grow their church and grow their pocketbook by preaching what's called kind of a prosperity gospel. And it frustrates me. It angers me deeply because there are some who will preach this message that, hey, you want to be blessed in this life? Well, you better give. In fact, let's take another offering. Let's have the ushers come forward and let's say, you know, you're not blessed yet. Well, then you're not giving enough. If you want a blessed life, you better give more. It's kind of this prosperity gospel. And there's pastors all over. There's kind of one in the South guy, you've probably seen him on TV. He's kind of famous for this. His name's Joel Osteen. And I got nothing against the guy, but I have a real big problem with that kind of teaching. This pastor has a net worth of $40 million, lives in a $12 million home. I mean, I'm just saying, when I look at the life of Jesus, it kind of makes me want to start chucking some stuff, right? Like, I mean, Jesus was poor, right? The best shepherd that ever lived. Couldn't even pay his own taxes. I mean, Caesar came and had to collect taxes from Jesus. How did Jesus pay his taxes? He told Peter, hey, go down to the lake, cast a line. First fish you catch, that'll have two coins in it. That'll pay my tax and your tax. I mean, Jesus had this care and this regard for people, not for this return of investment. And this is where Nehemiah just starts cleaning house. And of course, today, the temple is really a picture of your life, your body. Your body is to be a temple of God. And I just want to challenge you this morning. Maybe there's some things in your life that just need some gutting, just need some cleaning out in the name of truthfulness. That's the first reform. The next two go much quicker. The second reform picks up in verse 15. He says this. He says, in those days I saw people in Judah treading wine presses on the Sabbath. Notice how many times he says the word Sabbath. and bringing in grain and loading it on donkeys, together with wine, grapes, figs, and all other kinds of loads. And they were bringing this all into Jerusalem on the Sabbath. Therefore, I warned them against selling food on that day. People from Tyre, who lived in Jerusalem, were bringing in fish and all kinds of merchandise and selling them in Jerusalem on the Sabbath. To the people of Judah, I rebuked the nobles of Judah and said to them, "What is this wicked thing you are doing, desecrating the Sabbath day? Didn't your ancestors do the same thing so that our God brought all this calamity on us and on this city? Now you are stirring up more wrath against Israel by desecrating the Sabbath." He says it over and over again. This church, you've lost the importance of a Sabbath. You've lost the importance of having one day that's holy to God. And he says, isn't this like history repeating itself? Isn't this what got us in trouble in the first place? In fact, when Babylon came into Jerusalem, that's the book of Daniel, and conquered it, it was all because the people had lost sight of this idea of just one day of rest. See, we're made in the image of God, the God who created everything, created the cosmos, created the earth and the atmosphere and vegetation and animals, and then the pinnacle of God's creation is you and me. And then it says God rested. There's this rhythm to God and the way he works where there's work and there's rest. And I would say that in this way, it's really more than pride. If you can't rest, if you can't have one day, it's really a sign of pride that you can't rely on God. So Nehemiah calls them out, and he really is bringing about this personal revival. And personal revival is a rhythm of work and rest. Hey, I'll tell you, all day long, I mean, Christians should be the people that are known for hard work. Like, we should be the ones that are at the top of our game in whatever we're called to do. Not for our own advancement, not even for our boss, but for all glory to go to God. That's kind of the way I've tried to live my life. Colossians 3:23, you know, whatever you do, work at it with all of your heart. But we also need to have this balance of working hard, but then resting and relaxing and trusting God. I would simply just say and challenge you, do you have one day where you rest? Just one day where you're fully present to the people around you. Fully present not to your phone or not to the demands of the day or even the projects or the kids' activities, but one day where you're just kind of able to enjoy the presence of God and the people around you. That's his idea of reform that's so needed in this city. Last idea, and kind of the heart of the matter, picking up at the very end of the book, in verse 23, we read these words from Nehemiah. He says, "Moreover, in those days I saw men of Judah who had married women from Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. Half of their children spoke the language of Ashdod, or the language of one of the other peoples, and did not know how to speak the language of Judah. I rebuked them and called curses down on them." Gets ugly. "I beat some of the men and pulled out their hair. I made them take an oath in God's name and said, 'You are not to give your daughters in marriage to their sons, nor are you to take their daughters in marriage for your sons or for yourselves.' Was it not because of marriages like these that Solomon, king of Israel, sinned? Among the many nations, there was no king like him. He was loved by his God, and God made him king over all Israel, but even he was led into sin by foreign women. Must we hear now that you two are doing all this terrible wickedness and are two being unfaithful to our God by marrying foreign women?" It's pretty easy to see his reform, his last reform in the book of Nehemiah, has an issue to do with marriage, has an issue to do with really this idea of not interrace. He's not opposed to people of other races. What he's really opposed to is people marrying other people from other religions. It's really a religion problem at the issue. And these Jews were marrying women from Ashdod and Ammon and Moab. And you got to know that these were different religions completely. I mean, completely different worldviews. In fact, the Moabites would have been known for, part of their family values were to have child sacrifice in their family. And so just think about that. How does that work in a people of who are supposed to be following the one true God, if you have one person married to the other person who says, "Hey, let's have a baby. Let's sacrifice our baby," right? Like, it wouldn't work. And this is showing us in so many ways how God's design is for husband and wife to be on the same page spiritually. It would be the same problem today if someone from two completely different worldviews were married to one another. It would be hard to decide. How do you decide how you're going to worship and how you're going to serve and how you're going to raise your family and raise the values in your home. And this leads to kind of the last reform that I want to talk about this morning, and that's that personal revival is a faith-centered family. I feel like I could say that every Sunday, that what really matters is what you do in your home and what you do to raise up this next generation. I mean, this seems to be really what gets Nehemiah so worked up. I mean, he yells at a guy, he curses a guy, he beats a guy up, he pulls their hair out of their beard. One commentary I read, I think, got it right. It said, I think Nehemiah has gone a tad too far. You think? I mean, he's really kind of gone way beyond self-control in this moment. But I think it shows us again the need for families, to fight for families. I'll tell you as your pastor that Christians, we should never be the ones out there looking to pick a fight. But we should never be the ones to lose a fight either. And I believe in the fight for our families, that families matter, and that we need to do everything we can to raise them, to know and to worship God. I want to just simply close this time with just a few questions. And I realize this is a challenging chapter to end the book on. It's a strange chapter, I'll admit. But if we're going to own the vision that God gives us, then we're going to have to learn that faith sometimes isn't a set it and forget it kind of faith, that we all need personal revival. So I'm going to invite the worship team to come up and to give us some time to just truly think about these words in light of our relationship with God. And I just want to ask you a few questions, just maybe a few questions. And if you want to close your eyes or if you want to just kind of just bow your head and think about these questions and just kind of take these up between you and God. First question I would ask is very simply, what are you tolerating? I mean, what are you tolerating right now that God is kind of speaking to you and saying you need to speak truth into that? Could be a family member, could be someone that you love that is just kind of living a life just off track, and God is calling you to speak truth into that situation. Maybe God is challenging you to kind of clean some stuff out of your own life just in the sake of truthfulness. Second question, do you have a balance of work and rest? Do you ever take a break? Are you always moving and always feeling like you're needed? Do you ever just rest? And then the last question, how's your family doing? How's your family? Is there anyone in your family that just needs extra prayer right now? Anyone in your family that just needs maybe some additional encouragement? And God is kind of calling you to be that leader in your home, to lift them up and to come alongside of them. So I'll pray for you now. Father God, we just pause and we thank you again for these words. We thank you that at times your word is a hard word and it brings about this opportunity for reform and for revival, God. And so we just thank you for that. We thank you for the truth that can move us in the direction of a deeper and clearer walk with you, God. And so I just pray. I pray for this entire church and anyone within the sound of my voice, God, that we would live in light of your word and that we would live in the light of your truth. God, we thank you for Jesus. We thank you for the way in which we can find all of our grace in him. That his grace covers all of our sin that can be so deep at times. But he offers us this life and this life eternal. And so, God, we're going to sing to you now. We're going to give you all the glory that you deserve. And it's in your name we pray.
This podcast is a service of Bridgeway Community Church in Rockford, Michigan. Visit bridgewaycommunity.org for more information and other messages.